great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're going to take a look at organ donations on the program today. Whether you're looking to donate an organ or organs, or maybe you're on the waiting list to receive one, maybe you want to know a bit more about it, you're going to want to hear what our guests have to say today. Dr. Toby Campbell is one of our guests. He's the Chief of Palliative Care for UW Health, a medical oncologist for UW Health's Carbone Cancer Center, and a professor of oncology at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Toby Campbell, welcome. Thanks for joining in today.
Thank you, Larry.
Great to have you with us. Also great to have with us Dr. Nicole Neidlinger, transplant surgeon for UW Health and medical director of UW Organ and Tissue Donation, also an associate professor of surgery at the UW School of Medicine. Dr. Nicole Neidlinger, welcome to you.
Thank you. Thanks, Larry, for having us.
And as you listen to our experts talk, I hope you'll join our conversation. Have you signed up for to become an organ donor? Maybe you're waiting for one. I hope you'll join in with your questions about the process. Give us a call. The number, 1-800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Maybe Dr. Neidlinger, we can start with you. How important is it to have people willing to donate organs?
Well, Larry, I think this is a great question. So currently there are more than 100,000 people on the waiting list for an organ in the United States. And for the folks who are on that list, they've exhausted their options. So they have end-stage organ failure. I will say the majority of them have kidney failure. Probably 80% of the waiting list is in kidney failure. And for them, the really only option they have at continuing a life that, is sort of manageable for them to live and not tied to dialysis as a kidney transplant. So for those folks, it's really important that people consider donating an organ at the end of life.
Yeah. How does have numbers? I can recall some years back reading that Wisconsin was pretty good compared to other states, but still had a long way to go for improvement, Dr. Campbell.
Well, I think Dr. Neidlinger is good to comment on this, especially as the director of the Organ and Tissue Donation Program. But, you know, I would just say, Larry, that you're absolutely right that this is an important topic for people to think about. And I hope today's conversation will prompt people to think about that. How do they feel about this idea of organ donation?
Yeah, and it's definitely true that in Wisconsin, you know, it's several thousand people on the waiting list. And this is a state that has been very generous toward organ donation for legislative and I think cultural reasons. There, more than 60% of Wisconsin drivers have signed up to be organ donors, which is favorable. But despite that, there's really, frankly, a shortage of donors. So the list continues to grow at a rate that is quicker than we can transplant people. And the biggest limiting factor is availability of organs. So there's still quite a few people who have the opportunity to donate, and we just aren't reaching those folks.
I read somewhere that one organ donor can help more than 75 people.
That's true, too. So one potential donor typically can donate, in terms of their solid organs, things like lungs, hearts, kidneys. People can donate up to 8 organs. And then additionally, people donate tissues. These are things like corneas, ligaments for, you know, knee replacements or ACL reconstructions, skin for burn victims or cancer reconstruction victims. So in addition to donating solid organs, people can donate tissues to, as you said, up to 75 people. So it's really an incredible gift that people have the opportunity to do.
Yeah. And I may talk about it later, but I've received two, a bone marrow and a cornea from two different people. So that's been, I'll tell you, there's nobody who feels more close to those folks anonymously contributed that than I am, for sure. It's a humbling experience to have that, you feel very, very grateful.
Life-altering.
Well, yeah. Yeah, I received a cornea transplant, for example, from a person, I don't know who it was, but a woman from northern Wisconsin. And you can look and see that I'm looking at three computers here, and there's one split screen. And so I definitely need that cornea. And so, and a lot of people are in much worse condition than I. But I imagine, you know, you've dealt a lot, Dr. Campbell, with transplant patients, donor families. How difficult are those conversations you have with potential donors?
Well, talking to a donor family, I would say, is one of the most unusual and extraordinary conversations in all of medicine. And it's a truly unique and one-off conversation, Larry, because when you're talking to someone about surgery, in every other instance, the intent of that surgery is to help the person who's receiving the surgery. Now, it may not work, but the intent is to help that person. This is the only surgery like it in all of medicine where the intent is actually to help someone else. So the organ donation surgery, because it occurs in a very small eligible population, right? Dr. Neidlinger can speak to this, but you have to sort of, in a weird way, you have to sort of die in the right way to be an organ donor. And that turns out to be a pretty rare opportunity, which is one of the reasons why, you know, 60% of people have signed up to be organ donors, but very few organs actually become available because people die in ways that are not conducive to organ donation. Mm-hmm. But to have that conversation, it's done by experts, organ request specialists, people who have trained to navigate these really, really difficult conversations. I mean, imagine it. You're going to meet with a family on their worst day. They're in an ICU. They are literally in their worst day, a day that they never imagined would happen. And this is the circumstances in which you meet this family and have to walk them through this potential possibility to assess whether or not their loved one would be interested or not. And it's an amazing and a really difficult conversation.
Is it an easier conversation when the person has in advance said that they wish to be and filled out whatever needs to be done?
This is perhaps the takeaway message for me is I hope that this we made a podcast called Extraordinary Conversations, and this conversation that we're having with you today stimulates people's desire and willingness to have that conversation with their loved ones. Those people in your life who, if something catastrophic happened to you and you had some terrible brain injury, those people who would speak for you on your behalf, I think you want to let them know how you feel about things like organ donation. Because, yes, I've met with families who have no idea what their loved one would think, and families who know what their loved one would think, regardless of which way, right? Yes, organ, no organ, doesn't matter. Knowing when you have to speak for someone, what they would say is such a comfort to those families in that terrible time that it's a tremendous gift you're giving to your loved ones.
Yeah. Well, what kinds of concerns would they have?
Well, I think some of the most common concerns relate to body integrity. Some people feel really strongly about their body staying whole as it dies and goes on, whether that be religious or cultural reasons. I think body integrity is one of the most common reasons people mention not wanting to be an organ donor.
Yeah. I was thinking about this past year, in fact, just a few weeks ago, I lost my second brother. So I lost both my brothers this past year, and neither one of them would have been eligible due to the circumstances of, you know, themselves to be organ donors, even though I think they both had that seal on their driver's license. Mm-hmm. But I sort of flashed on that when you were talking about the fact that a lot of people might sign up but aren't eligible. In the end, they're not eligible anyway.
Maybe I could say a little about that. I think following up on what Dr. Campbell said, in order to donate your organs, your solid organs, you have to essentially die in a hospital. So a lot of people, that's just not the case. I mean, by their own choice, I think some people are in hospice or choose to die at home. Some people, you know, suffer some sort of event on the freeway or in the fields and never make it to a hospital. So for those folks, they're not eligible to donate organs because to donate an organ, your organ has to be getting blood and oxygen essentially the time up till it's recovered. So I think that alone limits a lot of potential donors from being able to donate organs. Now, you can still donate tissues, the things we talked about earlier, so ligaments, heart valves, corneas, generally within about 24 hours of your death. But for organs, it's a really unique group, so it limits the number of people who can donate. And then I think additionally, maybe what you're bringing up is we have to be careful about the potential to transmit something to recipients. So if someone's cause of death had to do with something that could be spread, to a person getting an organ, then we have to be wary of that. So there are certain infections or cancers that would limit someone. But something that I hear a lot that I think is important to clear up is a lot of people think that they are too old or too sick to donate their organs.
I hear that
a lot.
Given my age, I was.
We have organ donors that are, donating livers well into their 80s. I think we've even had organ donors over 90 now. So I think age in itself is not necessarily a rule out. And a lot of people will say things to us like, I can't donate because I once had hepatitis C or because of my habits, because I smoked or I drink, these types of things. And for organ donors, we have organ donors that are newborn infants all the way into their 90s. And we have people that have high blood pressure and diabetes and all sorts of other additional illnesses. I think it's important for people to know that you can, impact and save the life of another regardless of your health condition and a lot of situations that are surprising to people.
Hmm. Ryan Fond du Lac has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Roy.
Good morning. I'd just like to say that part of my questions were already answered in my comments, but I'm an attorney. I've done literally hundreds of probably 500 advanced care documents in my practice, and we always cover the issue of organ donations. And I just thought I'd mention some of the reasons that I get from people for not wanting to be an organ donor. One of them you've already hit upon, which was I'm too old. They're not going to want my organs. Another one is that I've been sick and they're not going to want my organs. The last one, which is pretty strange, but I've heard it on a number of occasions, probably more than I'd like to, is that if I am an organ donor, the doctors aren't going to do everything they can to save me because there is a lot of money in organ transplants. So I guess I will just leave that comment where it is and you can address whatever you'd like to out of that.
Absolutely.
Usually, when I hear one of the other earlier objections, I explain that where organs may be an issue if you've been sick or had some other problems, tissue like skin particularly is something that as a universal, it's a universal donation. So at any rate, I'll leave that for your
right.
panel to discuss. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Dr. Campbell, we'll turn to you for first.
Thank you for that, Roy. I think this is a really important, and let me try to address it by saying that I'm an oncologist and a palliative care doctor. I'm not actually involved in organ donation or in transplantation. And I was primarily interested in that conversation that we talked about because I'm a communications researcher and communications scientist. So I was interested in that extraordinary conversation. And that turned into this podcast, Extraordinary Conversations Podcast. But we heard, and so I came to this with a degree of skepticism, to be perfectly honest with all of you, about organ donation. Because when I had met people who were involved in this, it was mostly because they had not been able to donate and they were dying and these things were happening. But what I came to realize in interviewing people like Dr. Neidlinger is that there is an incredibly deep commitment to providing the highest quality care to everyone involved in this process, to the donor families, to the donors themselves, and of course to the recipients. I was incredibly impressed with the methodical and thorough nature with which people approach donors and donor families. And it's important for people to realize that ethically, and I think technically, these teams are kept separate. The donation side and the transplant side are kept separate so that there aren't these, I suppose, secondary gain or coercive attitudes towards these two things, because these two teams really operate separately and independently. And so I would want to reassure people that on the doctor side, people in the ICU who are taking care of someone, their entire mission is about providing the highest quality care that they can. And if someone is able to survive an illness or an injury, then that's what they're going for. In that moment when it is realized that that can't happen and that person is an organ, potential organ donor, then those conversations take place, and that's separate from transplant. And I think that's really important, because I perceived absolutely no conflict over that particular issue.
Yeah.
And when you were taking care of patients, I mean, as a physician in the emergency department, were you ever aware? Did you even know if they were on the donor registry? That's not typically a thing as physicians that is even known until, as you said, the point of time comes that either the person has died or is close to death.
Correct. Yeah. I don't think you even know. If you're an intensive care doctor or an emergency room doctor and you're taking care of someone, you're taking care of that person, it really only comes up after decisions have been made, when you realize this is not survivable, then this issue comes up. So it's really quite distinct and separate.
Yeah. We have Dale and Stephen's point. We'll get Dale, hang on. We'll get to you in a bit. But we are talking today to Dr. Toby Campbell from UW Health, Chief of Palliative Care for UW Health, Dr. Nicole Neidlinger, who is Associate Professor of Surgery at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, and Medical Director of UW Organ and Tissue Donation. You can join in too, along with Dale and Stephen's point. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're talking today about organ donations today with our two guests from UW Health, Dr. Toby Campbell and Dr. Nicole Neidlinger. Great to have both of them with us. And again, you can join in 800-642-1234. You could email to talk@WPR.org. And let's turn to Dale now in Stevens Point. Dale, thanks a lot for calling. What's on your mind?
First comment and then a question. The comment is I was fortunate to work in the medical field for in excess of 40 years, including as a physician's assistant working in dermatology. I must say that I, over my career, met many doctors that had graduated from UW-Madison, and without exception, they were really good at what they did. So there's that comment. My question is, in my estate planning, I'm giving my body, once I'm done with it, to medical science, University of Minnesota. But I would prefer, to give it to Wisconsin, University of Madison. Mm-hmm. How do I do that? Who do I contact? How do I go about it?
Mm-hmm. Dr. Campbell, do you want to take that?
For sure. Thanks for that question. So the UW has a body donation program, and I think if you just searched University of Wisconsin body donation program, you would find it. I think the key thing to know is that people who are interested in donating their bodies after death to the UW or honestly to other universities in other states, this is typically a decision that you need to make for yourself while you are of sound mind and while you are alive. It is not generally a decision that your family could make on your behalf after you have died. So I think the key thing is you look it up when your mind is clear and you're able to make that decision and express your preference. So you do it now. And I would search for the UW Body Donation Program.
Dale, there you go. Does that help?
Oh, very much so. Thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And you can join in again, 800-642-1234. Nicole in Shawano emailed to say she's heard that tissues from organs can be stored and used for other purposes, scientific or otherwise, and companies make a lot of money off of this. Apparently, people consent to this when they check that donation box and have no control over what happens to their tissues after they die. Dr. Neidlinger, can you address that?
Well, thanks for the question. I would say, so in my role, I work typically with organ donors. So as we mentioned before, tissue donors can donate within 24 hours of dying. And tissues are treated slightly differently. So the tissues are recovered and then quarantined until the donor can be tested and sort of clear the chart, cleared and clear testing. They're a little more stringent with regard to sort of infections and cancers that may exclude a tissue donor. There are tissue processors that are both for-profit and not-for-profit. And my understanding is that, you know, people have the right to decide, do I want to donate my tissues to one or both? So I believe that, you know, people have the right to exclude if they were to say, I only want to donate tissues to a, you know, this or that entity. I do think it's important, as you mentioned in your own experience, that the tissues can be life-altering and changing, like, just as much as organs. So I think they're a very important gift to give. There are some processors that are for profit, and not that those are a bad thing or sinister in any way, but I think patients have the right to decide what they wish to do with their, you know, parts after they die.
Makes sense. So if somebody dies, let's say there's a car crash or something, and the person hasn't filled something out, is it possible for the husband or wife or remaining family member to make that decision for them?
Yeah, we call that surrogate decision making. So when someone makes a decision on behalf of someone else, and in medicine we do this all the time, we meet with people who are unable to make decisions for themselves. They're too sick, they're in the ICU on a breathing machine, for example. If we feel someone needs an urgent decision and they aren't going to be able to make it for themselves, then we would turn to, in many cases, people have predetermined, as we heard from the lawyer earlier, like in a healthcare power of attorney, someone may have designated who is the person that I want to speak on my behalf. And I would suggest, by the way, to all of the listeners now, that having a healthcare power of attorney is a really important and helpful thing. I have one. I suspect Dr. Neidlinger does. It's an important thing to designate. This is the person that I would want to speak for me if I were ever unable to speak for myself. If you don't have a healthcare power of attorney, we have a process. We go to a spouse first and then adult children. We follow a process, but we want to try to work with your surrogates who can speak on your behalf, even including decisions about organ donation.
Yeah, I was thinking in my own situation, I was medical power of attorney over one of my brothers, and so I had to make some decisions. And those are, by the way, are difficult decisions to make if, you have a brother on a breathing tube and has a DNR, do not resuscitate order, and they say, well, do you want to go ahead with that? Do not, it's a very difficult situation for the person who's in that position. I can tell you that based on my own experience.
I don't think there are situations that are more difficult, to be honest. You're making life and death huge decisions on behalf of someone else who you love and care about. You are tired and exhausted. You're probably hungry. You're trying to make these decisions. In my world as a palliative care clinician, we are often working with families who are sitting in that very uncomfortable place and trying to help them navigate these difficult decisions in a way that respects the person for whom we're trying to make decisions for. But it can't really be much tougher, Larry.
No, I can tell you that for sure. And you think about it after the fact for a long, well, I'm still thinking about that, all these months later. We had a couple of emails. They relate to things we've kind of covered. Anne in Madison called, couldn't stay with us, wondering about donating her body for study at university. And I That can certainly, again, where do you go for?
You would search for the UW Body Donation Program. That would be the best way to go about that particular request.
And Tom, again, had wanted to know, and this bears repeating, I think, if there's an age limit after which person's organs cannot be donated, Dr. Neidlinger?
No age limit. I mean, we've had organ donors older than 90, so no age limit.
No age limit. You, Dr. Neidlinger, you perform organ procurement surgery, I guess is the way that, yep. The nice way to put it.
I think that's right. I think that's right.
Explain that.
So an organ procurement surgery is only occurring, of course, after someone has died and either they themselves or their surrogates, as we've talked about, has given their authorization for their organs to be donated. But it is a really unique experience. As a transplant surgeon, I was trained to do this, and I got to tell you, like, it's the things that you know, sort of can't unsee, like the whole magnificence of it all. You typically will fly, if it's greater than 100 miles, on a small plane, often in the middle of the night, to the hospital where the donor has died. And you will meet that person's loved ones, their people, and the people that have been with them at the end. And I try to thank them for the gift that they've given. It's always a challenging conversation because, again, like we've said, you're meeting them in the worst day. I mean, yeah. They never anticipated this. And then we really honor donors in a lot of ways. And one of those is by something called an honor walk. So typically when an organ donor is going from the ICU to the operating room where you actually perform the procurement, there's often a line of, you know, hospital employees, nurses and you know, respiratory technicians and physicians that are honoring the person in silence, sort of shoulder to shoulder the whole way to the operating room. And then before we start the procurement, we also do a moment of silence, and we often will offer some reflections that the family has given us about their person, and so that we, you know, sort of pay homage to the fact that this is a person who has given such a tremendous thing. And the operation itself takes us several hours, and it is anatomically an amazing operation, but it's also very profound in that at a certain point during the operation, it becomes, you know, apparent that you're going to remove the organs to save someone else and fill this person's, you know, body with ice. And it's a really incredible and profound experience. And then you bring these organs back in a cooler, and where others have been waiting for perhaps years to receive them. The whole thing is probably the most, you know, it's the biggest privilege of my life to be able to do it, but it's a very profound experience.
On the third episode, I got to join the team on a recovery, got to ride on the small plane, and I can attest that this is an almost unbelievable experience from start to finish. And the energy and enthusiasm and amazing coordination of, I don't even know, 1,000 moving parts in multiple different places, you know, because there are recipients who've been called to the hospital, right? Because the team is going on a recovery mission. So the recipients are on their way to the hospital. Sometimes, Larry, if a liver is going to one place and the kidneys are going to a different place and the lungs are going to a different place, you might have three, four, five, six different recovery teams who are working together in the operating room to recover their organ that's going to their hospital and that organ that's going to that hospital. It is kind of mind-boggling, Larry, the coordination that happens.
Yeah, you guys, and the way you've both described it brings a tear to my eye. I mean, it's really something. Sarah in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. I'm so appreciating this conversation between you and your experts. And I am a patient advocate lawyer, and I just wanted to clarify one thing about power of attorneys for healthcare in Wisconsin. I run the Center for Patient Partnerships, and it is essential that people in Wisconsin get a power of attorney for health care because there actually is no default decider in Wisconsin. If you don't have one, then your loved ones need to get a guardianship, which can be very expensive and time-consuming. So certainly law in action means that if there's no conflict in the family, that doctors, as was described, often do look to the spouse. But technically, they're not supposed to. They're supposed to be a court process to appoint a guardian.
Sarah, thank you very much for calling. Dr. Campbell?
Well, yes, thank you, Sarah. Thank you for that important clarification, and thank you for your work. I mean, if you all don't know, the Center for Patient Partnerships is an extraordinary organization that I support in any way that I can, and I just think her advice is great.
Yeah. Sarah, thank you very much for your additional comments there. Dr. Neidlinger, you actually specialize in kidney transplants. Why is that? I mean, I think you do others, but why choose that surgery specialty?
I'll tell you, I love doing kidney transplants. I've been doing them now it's been almost 20 years, and it is like an amazing, life-changing operation, and we do them on folks that have typically had quite a bit of waiting time, and they have a life often on dialysis, which is not a great life. So that generally is looking like 3 or 4 times a week for 3 or 4 hours per time, you know, in a chair hooked up to machines. They're unable to travel and do a lot of the things that bring them joy. And when we're able to give them a kidney transplant, the operation takes us, you know, 2-3 hours. And the most amazing thing I've ever seen is that we attach a kidney and then open it up to blood flow. And before we can even hook the urine tube up, often it starts, you know, functioning as a kidney. It's amazing. And every time I've seen it thousands of times now. But every time I'm like, this is a miracle. This is amazing. And a lot of times we'll have, you know, learners, because we're in an academic center. So often we'll have, you know, residents and medical students, and I see the looks on their faces, and I'm like, I still have that look. It is. And the patients, I mean, their life is completely changed, and often they're out of the hospital in, you know, 3-4 days with a whole new lease on life. So I love doing kidney transplants. It's my favorite. And
I can see why.
In the podcast project, I interviewed a number of transplant surgeons, and many of them had not pre-contemplated a career in transplant medicine until a surgery like this that they just happened to walk into when they were a resident, and they saw the kidney making urine, and then they were like, okay, this is what I'm going to do.
It's amazing. And Dr. Campbell, you've mentioned in passing your podcast, maybe explain that a little bit more, because there may be people who, I mean, you were describing, and I assume that was in your podcast, your trip.
Yes, was not a podcaster before this project, but I have always been motivated by really hard conversations. And so I wanted to open up the box a little bit and let people peer into this world of organ donation and transplantation. So I carried my microphones with me for actually 3 or 4 years, and I interviewed around 50 people all throughout this process, and essentially we followed organs from a donor all the way through to recipients. And so it's 6 episodes. You can find it on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get podcasts. It's called the Extraordinary Conversations Podcast. Our website is extraordinaryconversationspodcast.com, but you can find it on Spotify or Apple or wherever, and you can give it a listen. We interviewed really amazing people. And I think the product that we put together, I'm really proud of, to be honest. It was.
It's terrific. It's terrific. It highlights the stories and does such a good service to the whole enterprise.
And again, the title is?
Extraordinary Conversations Podcast.
Okay. Joel Patnon's our producer today. Joel, would you put that podcast up on, as you're listening, put that podcast link up on our page today. And we'll get that in case people don't forget or they won't, but they in after the fact and want to know where it is. And Joel just sent me a note. Will do. So we'll have that up about 2 hours after the show's over. We'll have that up on the talk at wpr.org/Larry. Go to today's date and we'll have that link if you'd like to follow up. And I want to do it myself because I think it sounds extraordinary. Sherry in Elkhorn has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Sherry.
Hi. Hello.
Hi. What's on your mind?
I just wanted to let someone know that we've gone through the whole process, the honor walk and everything with our 35-year-old son. And we knew that he wanted to donate, so it was not a hard decision for us because we had talked about things, you know, openly for a while. But he was taken right immediately by a stroke, and he did not come out of it. So we knew that he wanted to donate, and that decision was not hard for us to make. And the thing that happened to us, though, was he went, you know, into the surgery, and he was on a respirator, and we thought he was dying, and so did the physicians, but he hung on after they pulled the respirator and was still breathing for a while. So there were a lot of the organs they couldn't use because he was no longer on the oxygen. And we were so disappointed.
Yeah.
But there were some, he was able, I believe, to donate his eyes and some tissue, but the major organs were, we were so hoping that, you know, he would live on.
Yeah.
Well, Sherry, if I could say something, Sherry, like one thing I want to say is thank you so much for your and your son's gift. Like, I hopefully you've heard this before, but, you know, as a representative of a lot of recipients, it's not lost on us the magnitude of people's gift. And I think the intention to donate is what matters. So thank you for that. I think that what is being mentioned here is that in order to donate your organs as a deceased donor, you have to have died to take them out. And there are two routes to do that. So about half the donors have died of a neurologic insult, so a brain insult, and they're declared brain dead. And those folks can go to the operating room once they're declared dead in an ICU and have their organs recovered. There's a second category of folks who do not meet the criteria for brain death. So they may be, they often are, obtunded or comatose, very close to death, but they do not meet the very strict criteria for brain death. And in those folks, they go to the operating room and have, as Sherry mentioned, the breathing tube and the respirator removed. And if their heart stops in a certain time period, then we recover their organs for transplant. Now, there is a maximum amount of time that the organs can sustain, you know, being off the breathing tube, because that happens when they get to the operating room. And generally, if the person's heart doesn't stop in a predesignated time period, which is usually a couple of hours, then it renders the organs, unfortunately, unable to be transplanted. And it sounds like perhaps that was the experience that Sherry's family had. I am sorry that that happened. It's very hard to predict, you know, which patients will die after a compassionate extubation. But I do want to say thank you to you and your son and your family for being willing to give the gift, and also that he was able to give tissues, which is a tremendous gift as well.
Sherry, I also want to say thank you. And hearkening back to the earlier question about the integrity of these teams being separate, I think, Sherry, your story actually highlights that the care that we're providing to donors is just for donors, and we want to take the best care of them that we can. And if they are not dying, right, which is to say that their heart didn't stop and they didn't die in a way that was fast enough, if you will, while it's kind of crushing because that was your family's bright spot that you were looking forward to, on the other hand, it sort of highlights that we are, as a medical system, providing the best quality care to that donor that we can until the moment that they die, and then it switches to transplant. So it should, at the same moment as it was crushing for you, it should give hope to those families who worry that people are taking organs, like the earlier caller mentioned. This is a case that sort of highlights that doesn't happen.
Well, and Sherry, as someone who has received a cornea, I can tell you that is very much, I very much appreciate that gift. And so you can take some solace in that for sure. Thank you very much for calling. Melissa, let's go to Melissa in Madison. Melissa, hi.
Hey,
thank
guys.
You for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Just curious, like, so I registered as a donor when I was, whatever, 15 and a half or something, when I first got my driver's license at the DMV. I'm no longer 15. I was a little confused about, do I need power of attorney? Like, if I'm registered, is that enough, or do I need to go do other paperwork? Does anyone, and I know you're not attorneys, but just curious if you could clear that up a little bit.
You know, and we'll get to that in just a minute. I'm realizing that I get involved in the conversation, and I forget about breaks that I have to take. Let's take one right now, and we'll come back with an answer, Melissa, so don't worry about that. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at organ donation on the program today with Dr. Toby Campbell and Dr. Nicole Neidlinger from UW Health. Great to have them with us. Greg in Madison has a question. Let's go to Greg. Hi, Greg.
Hello, Larry. I know this is an organ donation process, and I know that the surgeons, it's expensive to have a surgeon do this, and the transportation of the organ from these locations to the hospitals, and that process is expensive. I'm just wondering, I don't feel great about the question, but does the hospital charge for the organ itself? Or, I mean, it's donated.
Yeah, okay.
And there's an expense to the process.
Yeah, understood, Greg. Dr. Neidlinger?
Yep, I've got an answer to that. I think I can help clarify this. So organs can't be bought or sold, and they're not bought or sold, but there is, as you're describing, expense that goes into the process to work up someone for donation, to do the appropriate testing that you need to do on the organs, to be able to fly and recover the organ and bring it back. There are associated expenses with that. So one thing that I think is important to tell the listeners is that the family will not, the donor nor their family will not incur those additional expenses. So where those expenses do go is that there is an acquisition fee, what it costs to obtain a kidney for transplant, for instance, and that the insurer of the recipient will cover those expenses. So the insurance company is delighted, honestly, to cover the costs to acquire a kidney for transplant because it's a fraction of the cost to maintain someone on dialysis. So the biggest insurer, and I think we don't need to get in the weeds on it, but is Medicare for kidney patients. So the expenses to acquire the organ will be covered by whoever the insurer is of the recipient. And those costs don't go to the family.
Greg, thank you very much for calling. Charles in Oshkosh, your turn. Hi, Charles.
I do a lot of estate planning with the declaration to healthcare professionals and powers of attorney, and a question often comes up: when is a person in a terminal or persistent vegetative state that they will not recover? Some people say, "What if I come out of a coma after 20 years?" You know, but anyway, I assume the process is declaring someone brain dead is a scientific thing. The other issue is if there's any incentives, anybody. I know if you donate your body for anatomical study, in some places the institution, the university, will come and pick up the body at no charge. They'll use the person's body for anatomical study, and then when they're done, after a semester or two, they will cremate the person at no charge and return their cremains, or even bury them at an unmarked cemetery at Picnic Point in Madison. So I don't know if there's any incentives like that financially for organ donation, too, or not. Thank you.
I'll let Dr. Neidlinger comment about the incentives, but my impression is there are no financial incentives for donation. I think it's important to try to keep that process as clean and as just based on decision-making as possible. The body donation program, my understanding, if someone's body is, for example, being used in an anatomy lab to teach future doctors anatomy, because as that process unfolds, pieces are being removed, right? The liver comes out, the heart comes out as that's being further dissected. There is a cremation process that happens afterwards. Families are given cremains, although I do think that it is a collective cremains, and I think that they make that process pretty clear. And I'm not honestly sure at all if burial happens. I don't, it's hard for me to imagine that it happens on Picnic Point, but I don't know the answer to that.
I have not heard that. I will echo that we can't financially incentivize organ donors. You know, I think it's cleaner to not. There are rules around, you know, directly paying organ donors. So we unfortunately, I mean, or fortunately, cannot pay families or people for their organs. But I think it keeps sort of integrity in the process in that way.
Can you get away with, in terms of being an organ donor, with just that seal on your driver's license?
That's a great question. I think the previous caller, Melissa, had asked that as well. So I don't want to discourage anyone from doing a healthcare power of attorney because they're much more thorough in terms of what you're able to designate. But people are able to designate their desire to donate organs and tissues on the donor registry. So I think that's what was being mentioned earlier. The vast majority of people are doing that at the DMV because the question gets asked directly at the DMV. If you have, you know, signed up at the DMV, it is a legal binding document as long as you are 18 years or older. So I think the previous caller who signed up at 15 and a half, we would still seek their legal surrogate's permission unless the person was after 18 once they died. So you can make decisions about your ability to donate organs on the registry, and you can also do that at heroicdeed.com. But again, a healthcare power of attorney is going to be the best way to make more broad end-of-life decisions for yourself beyond just organ donation.
And I would just add that at the time you make that designation, I would strongly encourage you to talk to the people in your life who love you, who care about you, who would be in a position to make decisions for you if you ever needed someone to speak for you. Let them know that you made that decision. I've met with families who are struggling with this, and the knowledge that their loved ones signed up and then the verbal confirmation that they've signed up and that this was a decision that they made is so helpful to those families in that moment.
Yep. Yeah. Agree.
Thank you, Charles, again. And Paige in Mount Pleasant, we're running out of time, but if you got 30 seconds here maybe to make a comment.
Well, I just wanted to thank all those who actually have made the decision to be organ donors. I've been blessed to have a sister who's now 54. She had her first liver transplant at the age of 6, and at that time it was experimental. And if it wasn't for the fact that so many people were thankless and selfless and willing to give that, I would not have had the blessing of having a sister still with me today.
That's a wonderful comment, Paige. Thank you very much. And it's probably, I hope you receive those kinds of comments through your work, both of you. Dr. Neidlinger?
Yes, Paige, thank you so much for that comment. I couldn't agree more. I think the fact that people on the worst day that they never imagined coming decide to say yes to helping out another person is to me evidence that the world is still a great place, honestly. People, it matters to people to leave a legacy, and altruism matters. And I agree with you. To all of the listeners out there who are on the donor registry or to donor families, some have called in today who have agreed to give this gift. I just want to personally also thank all of those folks and say that it's not lost on us as transplant surgeons, the magnitude of the gift that is.
And I would just close by saying it's easy to imagine recipients, just as your sister is, that they derive benefit. In my interviews with donor families, people who made that decision on behalf of someone else, I was honestly and genuinely surprised in such a heartfelt way that the decision to donate, and they spoke a lot about legacy, for example, but the decision to donate powerfully influenced their grief experience for years to come in a positive way.
And on that note, I want to thank you both for the work you do and for being with us today. Thank you very much, Dr. Toby Campbell and Dr. Nicole Neidlinger, with us today to talk organ transplants from UW Health. Great to have them with us here on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're switching gears, and Jill Nadeau, my executive producer, will be joining us next, right after this look at the news. Stay with us.